Hello and welcome to Into the Wild, the podcast that brings you animal facts, wildlife updates and nature stories from the professionals to you. Beavers in the UK, they've come, then they've gone, then they've come again, then they've gone, and now they're coming back again, and this time we want them to stay. For years, many organisations have worked hard to get beavers back in the English ecosystems, and with recent news of the UK government giving the right to remain to some family groups of beavers on the River Otter in Devon, this work has had so much more rightful attention in the media. This week, I speak with James Wallace, Director of the Beaver Trust, to discuss how and why beavers are important and what they can do to an ecosystem. We also discuss the importance of collaboration of organisations and different industries in order to work together to strive for success. Thanks so much for tuning in and enjoy the show. James, welcome to Into the Wild. Thank you so much for joining me on today's show. First of all, how are you doing?
Hello, Ryan, and thank you very much for welcoming me. I am very well indeed. How are you?
I'm good. Like I said to you, it's Friday. People have been telling me that all day, which is apparently a great thing, so I'm excited for that. Welcome to the show. I'm really excited about chatting I won't give anything away. I'm just going to say I'm looking forward to talking to you. But before we dive into today's show, I put out a tweet yesterday. I don't usually do this, to get our listeners to decide what the title of the episode was going to be, because we've done an episode about beavers with Sophie Pavel, who you know very well, before. So I didn't want to call it Beavers with the Beaver Trust. So I didn't know what to call it. And the winner so far is Got Wood, which I'm over the moon about. I don't know how you feel about that.
Well, what a great way to start our conversation. I think highly appropriate. We can't have a light-hearted conversation about beavers without some sort of innuendo. So let's start now.
I thought if I throw that in at the top, it gives our listeners a good idea of how this conversation could go. But welcome to the show. It's a great honour to get to chat to you and have this time. But for the listeners, as we always do on Into the Wild, can you just tell us, James, who you are and what is it you do?
Sure. Well, I'm James Wallace. First of all, and most importantly, I'm a father of two amazing, beautiful daughters aged 11 and 13. And what I do is a lot to do with being a father in this world that we live in now. And that is, I'm extremely concerned. I'm excited, but also very, very concerned about the future that we face as a species and our planet. And so what I do as a father and as a worker is to try and help bring people together to come up with solutions for the climate and extinction emergency that we face. My background, very briefly, is setting up environmental organisations, for-profit or not-for-profit, and those tend to, well, they vary quite a lot, actually, from renewable energy and clean technology, funding mechanisms, ecotourism, city centre regeneration, and in the past 5 years, conservation. First of all, marine conservation, and now terrestrial, albeit focused on rivers, as we'll be discussing.
That's an amazing answer, how you started there, because that's something that I don't think I've actually heard anyone say before, is that first of all, I'm a father or a mother or just a parent, and I'm concerned for my children. I don't think we hear that enough from people.
Yeah, it's funny. I was on a government consultation call earlier with Natural England, which is really good, actually. It was about beavers and rivers, and I wasn't alone, actually. One or two other people reminded us all of the climate emergency that we're in. So we were talking about detailed policy, but we need to make sure these conversations always have the backdrop and context of the climate and ecological crisis we face, because if we don't have that, and if we don't remind ourselves that we're parents or uncles or aunts or whatever we are, then it's very easy to forget why we do what we do.
Absolutely, and I think that helps bring things closer to home when we look at it like that.
It certainly does. Yeah, I'm sorry. I'm drinking some homemade hibiscus tea, and I managed to get a whole hibiscus flower stuck in my mouth.
That's also the best sentence I've had on the show ever.
Well, it's just starting off very well.
Yeah, we've gone from the lowest form of wit from Got Wood to now talking about hibiscus tea. This is a beautiful conversation.
Yeah, although I can't claim to have grown it, it would have been imported by someone, but it is organic. That much I can say.
For you as well, how did your love for wildlife and nature begin for you, James?
at a very sort of personal level, I remember from a very early age being fascinated by nature and always feeling that I'm part of it and not separate. People talk about nature as if it's the other, but I always like to talk about the rest of nature, humans being a part of it. And yeah, I've got very fond memories, as many people do, if they were lucky enough to grow up in the countryside as I did. And you know, things like rescuing crows and growing veg with my parents and collecting and breeding butterflies and all sorts of different things. But I was also, I also had a shotgun and I was a fisherman. And in fact, it's something I refer to now with people that as a country dweller, I know where our food comes from and I've been part of that process. And so my relationship with nature has both been climbing and hugging trees and all those really, you know, naturalist activities. But also I recognise that we need to feed ourselves and that nature has Darwin said, is red in tooth and claw. We humans are too. So it's always been for me a really interesting journey, if you like, of discovery between the relationship between humans and nature. And it all really became a bit more formal, I suppose, when I moved from being a biologist and ecologist as a young, you know, as a student, if you like, and to a young adult when I became an archaeologist. And that was all about learning about the relationship between humans and nature and how we are very good, unfortunately, at not looking after the environment that sustains us.
Yeah.
And, you know, I studied the rise and fall of civilizations, for example, and the advent of technology and trade. And it's been really, really interesting to see how that archaeology, you know, looking back literally thousands and thousands of years, how we're seeing this journey replayed as if we're going round and round the same thing again and again. Each civilization rises and then it falls. And what's happening now, I ask? So using that sort of combination of being a naturalist and a country dweller with an archaeologist who has a deep interest and passion for human evolution and the connection and relationship between humans and nature, it's really interesting to see how we are now. This has never been a more important time with that relationship between people and the rest of the planet.
And I think, and this is going to be something that we're going to chat about during this show, I'm sure you will agree, that's the key point, is involving both sides of that kind of, to protect the nature, like you said, it's important to be part of it and understand that we are part of it and involve everyone. And like you said there, it's having those both sides of your mind and experience can really help you guide to, I guess, success with helping nature, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's really, really important for people to feel a sense of connection, ownership, empowerment, and dare I say it, without wanting to sound too sort of woo-woo, being at one with.
Yes.
I was very lucky to do after having been an archaeologist, I then had some time in the corporate world, which I left and tried to help set up things like CSR, corporate social responsibility. And then about 20 years ago, I did a master's degree in something called holistic science.
Ooh.
And it was at an amazing place, which I recommend to all your listeners to go and visit on a short course or even the master's course, a place called Schumacher College, which is at Dartington in Devon. And oh my goodness, it was a privilege. We were learning about climate science, natural systems theory, chaos theory, all these things. Now, how does nature really work? And how can we blend quantitative science, so the sort of, well, if I'm being a bit crass, sort of kill it, cut it up, put it under a microscope, measure it, you know, all that stuff, which we need to do.
Yeah.
But also look at the qualitative side of things. So what is the function, if you like, of a living organism whilst it's alive within its environment? And the only way to really do that is, dare I say it, not get rid of objectivity, because that's what we scientists strive for, objectivity, but to embrace subjectivity as well. And that's all about, again, connection, and not just connection between humans, but humans and the organism or ecology that we're trying to understand.
Today we're going to be talking about beavers in the UK. As I said briefly at the beginning, that you are the director at the Beaver Trust, and we're going to be talking about the recent, I guess I'm going to call it a success story, because that's how I see it, of Parliament giving some beaver families the right to remain on the River Otter in Devon. This got in the news recently. But before we get onto that bit, can you tell us a bit about the Beaver Trust as an organisation, and how and why it was set up?
Well, it's a small group of people who've come together in the past year and a half. We started working together officially anyway in March last year in 2019. And we all bring our own part to the story. So for me, as an archaeologist, I was very fortunate in 1994 to be one of a small team of people that discovered a beaver dam dating back to the Bronze Age.
Wow.
You can imagine, that was quite a surprise, bearing in mind we'd just spent a few years learning about archaeology, and no one had at any point in that process at university told us that beavers lived in England. which was quite weird, because if you can imagine, if you're digging, we call it a paleo channel, so an old channel, the River Thames. It's actually where the Olympic rowing lake is, a place called Dorney, west of London. Mm. And we were digging along, really hot summer, and this sort of big dark staining in the soil came across in front of us. And then what looked like the remains of sticks, and we couldn't work it out until the professor responsible told us. And then, lo and behold, a skeleton of a beaver was discovered. So we're talking about 3,500-year-old skeleton. And for me personally, beavers really, that was the first time I encountered beavers literally in person, although obviously a long time demised.
Yeah.
having tried to set up over many years all sorts of different enterprises and then focusing on nature restoration and conservation now, personally, I've been looking for, what's the ultimate natural climate solution? What's the ultimate natural partner that we can have between us humans and nature? And then the beaver, it appeared through all sorts of different reasons. One of them being my colleague Chris Jones, who runs the Cornwall Beaver Project with Cornwall Wildlife Trust and with us Beaver Trust quietly in the background. And at his farm, he has reintroduced beavers 3 years ago in 2017.
Wow.
And we have actually seen and studied, universities involved, for example, who have been able to measure the differences between before and after the beavers have come. And we'll come back to that later on about what they actually do. So we as a small team, there's Eva Bishop, who looks after our education side of things. There's Nikki Saunter, who helps set up the organisation with me, and a guy called Ian Beath. And I mentioned Chris as well. There's Sophie, who you've spoken to. That's our really small team with a bunch of volunteers. And what we've recognised, and this isn't really just about beavers, we weren't actually going to be called the Beaver Trust. We were going to be called the Natural Trust. However, the Charity Commission, in their infinite wisdom, decided that people might get confused with National Trust, albeit very different meaning.
That's very fair, yes.
Fairish. Depending on who you are. But they also wanted us to focus on something, not just a general nature restoration. And then we decided, well, let's focus on rivers, and let's use the beaver as an ally for nature restoration and river restoration, which they're very good at doing. But also, let's use, if we can use such a term, use beavers as a totem, as a figurehead for reconnecting people with nature. And why would we do that? Well, they do a lot of very useful things. They provide habitats for other live organisms, so they create the opportunity for life. By slowing down water, they prevent flooding when there's enough beavers on the river system. They also store water for droughts, and they allow for pollution to be removed to some degree, so agricultural pollution, for example. They sequester carbon through the habitats they form. And if you've ever been to a beaver wetland, you'll be literally bombarded by life. It's quite extraordinary to be immersed. Oh, we have to get you down to a site. It's amazing.
Oh, God, that's a formal invite. I'm stopping the podcast. That is a formal invitation. I'm coming down.
We'll make it happen. We'll do another one down there.
I'm in the car now, James.
So as far as the reason behind this, hopefully it's becoming apparent. This is an amazing animal. Now, lots of people are doing lots of things to try and help restore and reintroduce this species. And we've got to a point where there's been a bit of a hiatus, a bit of an impasse, where some people really want them and some people really don't, or at least feel that they might be troublesome, and they can be. So they can bring great benefits to people and communities. But they can also be a little disruptive. So we felt that it would be useful to set up an organisation that will stand in the middle. We are not pro-beaver, although we are sort of beaver believers, if you like. But we feel that it's really important to take that middle ground and help people who have an interest in, say, farming, fishing, shooting, forestry and so on, as well as the conventional conservation NGOs and government, to try and help bring them together to form an agreement on where these animals should live, how we should manage and coexist with them, how we can educate and inform the public and so on. So that's our role, really. Education, raising awareness, supporting community so community-led restoration can happen on our rivers, and to convene and bring people together. And we, you know, we make films. We're launching an educational hub on our website. We support communities with catchment-scale river restoration projects. We help raise funds and so on.
That's a very interesting point you said there about being, you know, pro or against. And I think this is something that I think through all social aspects of everything, that there's quite often people put a blanket response onto stuff. And I think, like you said there, it's very important sometimes to go, well, you know, it's okay to be in the middle ground of something and see pros and cons in order to get rid of that divide in people and actually bring it together to form one idea.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I think that really, you know, you were talking earlier about reconnection and people having a relationship with nature and each other. I think that's really the great work that we all are doing right now within the nature restoration and conservation movement is a coming together. It's a gathering and an aligning of goodwill, energy, funding, resources, experience, data, all these things. And we say, in fact, I personally say as the convener of a group of organisations that are working with government at the moment, that we want to unlock horns. We've had enough of all this positioning and posturing that tends to happen. And you know, when I say we, I mean, some of us within the group may have been guilty of that ourselves in our careers. You know, it's the way people behave. And funny enough, in fact, I've just written an op-ed on this, which I hope will be going out soon, which is the irony is that some of the organisations that we're dealing with, and this is not to be personal or blaming at all, it's just an observation that they'll probably agree with themselves, that they've become so entrenched in this scarce world of trying to squabble over the same members. If you're a large NGO, for example, large environmental charity, you have the same number of members to try and go after. That there's a very, very small amount of funding out there, Ryan, you probably know. I think it varies year to year, but it's sort of, you know, 5%, 7%, maybe even less of the funding out there is actually for the environment. So these organisations have become quite territorial in some respects. There's a lot of collaboration, and that's great to see, particularly on things like scientific research.
Yeah.
However, through need, in some ways, there hasn't been enough collaboration. So as far as we're concerned, that's the key. Work together.
Yes.
We've got an emergency. We've got to put aside our differences, whether we're an angler, a fisher, a farmer, a conservationist, a government minister, whoever we are, and we've got to work together to come around and solve these really serious problems. And we think river restoration, the security of our future water supply, it's that serious. 86% of our rivers are not safe to swim in or drink. Poor ecological health. That is not something to be proud of. If I'm going to roll out some figures, if any of your more geeky listeners might want to take some notes, here's one for you. There are 218 countries in the world, approximately. 189th. That is our ranking as a nation. We're the 189th worst state of nature in the world. And if you really sit on it, think about that. So that means we are 29th from the bottom.
Oh my
think
God.
Think about what countries we're thinking about. So we have removed the natural integrity and dynamism and vibrancy of nature within this nation over many hundreds of years to such a point that we are in many places an ecological desert. And this is not to blame people. You know, this is happening for economic reasons, for policy reasons and so on.
That's just... I can hear my brain going... What? Like, I didn't really... I mean, I knew it was bad, but that is in a terrible state. But then, like you said, 86% of rivers and waterways are not safe to drink or swim in. That's just unthinkable.
Yeah, it is. And some of the pollution events that happen, and, you know, again, I'm not the sort of person who wants to blame, but I will observe that there is bad practice. You know, we know there is some laziness, there is some bad practice, and some of it's driven by current policies. And the government officials are well aware of this. It's been going on for a long time, that the common agricultural policy, the way it's set up, and the way that farm payments are made, that they incentivise productivity. They don't incentivise, in most cases, they don't incentivise really good ecological stewardship. And that's changing. And that's really exciting. That's another reason why we've set ourselves up. This is the time. We can channel funding into good practice. We can encourage and reward farmers, for example, for ecosystem services, as people refer to them these days, or natural capital and those sorts of things. Public payment for public goods is a term the government tends to use now. That's really exciting, isn't it? You know, rather than rather than mounds of butter and wheat that get wasted or whatever that people used to talk about in the 70s and 80s, we're now coming to a point where we may actually be able to see that farmers and other people who are involved in production can be incentivized and properly rewarded to create space for nature. Because really, that's all we really need to do. Bit of coexistence management, little bit of funding, and just leave some space.
And like you said, when you really boil it down, it is that kind of, I don't want to say simple, but that kind of like, we just need the space to coexist and manage, and that is it. Now, that's some shocking things we've just heard there from the UK and our position, or should I say England and our position in the ranking in the countries. But let's talk about, because you said there are some people that are against beavers being back into the UK or into England's natural land, and some people are for. So why would people not want beavers in the wild in England?
That's such a good question. And it's a very complicated one for some people. And again, without wanting to try and understand everybody and what drives them, what we've observed and we've learned as newcomers, and it's quite good to do this as newcomers because you can come in an unbiased way with an open mind, is that a lot of people who do have issues, and we're talking about a very small number of people as a percentage of the population, the vast majority of the people consulted want to have beavers and their rivers restored. But a lot of those people who don't, or at least I think it's hard to say don't want them, because I think that's a bit strong. It's more that are concerned about them returning.
Yeah,
that might be a better way of putting it. And those people tend to be the ones whose livelihoods are affected by it. So, for example, I mentioned flood alleviation. Beavers at capacity can slow down floodwaters and are proven to do so across the Northern Hemisphere. And that's something we look forward to seeing happening in Britain. However, where they do it in the uplands, typically upstream, those farmers, typically those landowners, land managers that are hosts to these lovely animals are not necessarily the ones that will benefit, because the benefits are downstream. Do you see what I mean? So the cost of having beavers, in inverted commas, on your land is not where the benefit resides usually. Now, that it differs if you add biodiversity and wildlife to the argument, because if you have beavers slowing the water and creating a beautiful, braided, you know, vibrant habitat for other wildlife, then you will benefit because you will have more habitat and food for insect pollinators that will help your crops, for example. Or if you're into fishing and fisheries, then you'll have, in most cases, much better habitat for fish to dwell and to spawn. Now, some of the people who have issues around this are not only those who will make a living from the land that's abutting a river, but also from the river itself, and fisheries is an example. And the main concern that I'm hearing is from people who worry that a dam may block the movement of migrating salmonids to their spawning grounds.
Okay.
And what happens there, there isn't really much research to show this, but we understand why people might be concerned, because, of course, it's a barrier. Fish swim up the river. Now, if you're an American, you might have a bumper sticker that says, "Beavers taught salmon to leap." And if it wasn't beavers, I don't know what else it was. Deadfall trees, the odd waterfall. But beaver dams were everywhere. And these organisms co-evolved. So Eurasian beavers, castor fiber is their name, they co-evolved with our trees, with our plants, with our insects, and with fish and all our fairy friends out there in the wild. And so In a natural river system, it would be very much a surprise if beavers were to cause an issue there, because it would be natural. However, we live in one of the most heavily managed landscapes in the world, as I'm sure you know, Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you can imagine, our modern rivers have been, they use the term canalized, so that basically means narrowed and straightened. In the wisdom that once came out of the Victorian era, that was, we need to rush the water to the sea and drain our land. And the amount of wetlands that have been drained, even in the past 40 years, is astonishing. It's easy to forget. They talk about shifting baseline syndrome, which is basically generation after generation, we think what we're born with is normal, forgetting that a lot has been lost by previous generations. What we're seeing here then is rivers are very constrained in the modern landscape. Farming is pressured by these payments to plough up to the edge, you know, to cultivate and put chemicals right up to the edge of a river, which leads to increased pollution and soil runoff. There's no space for we call them riparian habitats, so that the habitats that run alongside rivers and streams. There's no space, not just for beavers, but for plants and other animals.
Yeah.
So what we have observed is that the people that have understandable, and I really do believe they have understandable concerns, are concerned about, is their crop going to be spoiled if the beavers cause localised flooding, which is what they do. I mean, they create dams and they slow the water and the river widens, so it will affect some crops. They might be concerned about the migration of fish. Again, we understand that too, absolutely. So what we say as an organisation, and many of the people we deal with, is that we need to have management of this species, and it needs to be properly planned and implemented, so that if you're a farmer or a fisher or you're a forester who's worried about losing a tree, that there's local support that can help to mitigate any negative impacts.
Now, if we look on the other side of the coin, and we have touched on there a few of the benefits that beavers can bring, so we can understand the reasons why people are concerned to have them back or have concerns of what could happen, what are the important parts of having beavers back in the wild in areas of the UK?
There are some people, practitioners, scientists and so on, who would go as far as saying that if we don't have beavers in our rivers, then they cannot be properly restored. It's as simple as that. These animals co-evolved with the other species that I mentioned earlier on. So if we go back in time to when we became an island, we then find that when those rivers started to become a bit like what they look like now, they would have had beavers all over them. As the ice retreated, beavers would have followed, and they would have created that opportunity for life I mentioned earlier on. So if we look at it in that time scale over the past many thousands of years, and we're talking many millions of years in the really long scheme of it, beavers have come and gone in this island many, many, many times. And there are plenty of archaeological remains of dams and of wetlands that show that to be the case all across our river catchments. I'm not aware of a river catchment in mainland Britain that has been proven not to have had beavers.
Oh, wow.
So with that, and it's not surprising, you know, they were a free-moving mammal. They're quite large rodents that can move not easily over a mountain. They're not going to be out there climbing, but they will move using water pretty much anywhere. So why would we want them back? If you think about the hydrology of what beavers can help bring about in a chalk landscape, for example, where I live in Wiltshire, we have winter bourns. They flow only for a few months of the year, and many chalk streams are in a period of drought. In fact, north of London, the Chilterns, the Rivers Trust report, I think it was last year, was saying that many of the streams that feed, you know, provide the water for London, North London, are in permanent drought, and they're flowing as low as 25% of normal, partly because of over-abstraction, partly because of lack of rain.
Yeah.
And that's a great concern. So when I look at this, I think, let's think big. Let's think about climate. Let's think about the extinction crisis. What do we need? We need water. I'm a fisherman. I wouldn't want anything to be a barrier to fish, but I know that one thing, and I wouldn't necessarily favour beavers over fish or fish over beavers, but one thing I am certain is both beavers and fish need water.
Yeah,
and I'm completely certain that fish do not generate water or create the space for it. Beavers do. So one way of looking at this, without wanting to sound oversimplifying this, because it is complicated, is that by having beavers, you will have more water and you will not have so many floods. And those localised floods are ones that we want to encourage, i.e. in the floodplain.
Yeah.
So if we were to develop less in our floodplains, which is frankly a bit of a stupid thing to do, I'm not talking about farming, I'm talking about buildings and infrastructure, then we would have less conflict. So one of the things that we like to encourage is for people to create buffer zones. So imagine a river to be allowed to breathe more naturally again around across the floodplain more. That would make such a significant difference. Just by taking that farming and other land uses back a bit, 20 yards over size, something like that, 20 metres, that would give the river the opportunity to flow more naturally, to slow the waters down, so there's water for times of drought and slow water for when there's spate and flood waters. So you're less likely to have those problems downstream that we talked about. And then when it comes to biodiversity, I mean, it's a bit of a dry word, we're talking about life, wildlife. Think of this, really basic stuff. If a dam is formed, water slows down, then the nutrients will drop, and with the water slowing, all the little particles of life, the zooplankton and algae, will form. That's the basis of the food chain. Mm-hmm. That then means invertebrates, and insects being some of them, will then have something to eat. Those invertebrates will then have predators. Those are fish, newts, frogs, birds, etc. And so on. And they will then feed up the food chain. So there's no reason to believe that with beavers back, we won't see storks across the country again. Imagine having mighty birds like storks and cranes, which do exist in very small numbers in parts of Britain. Likewise, the mammal population, the bird population, at Chris's farm, he has 8 new bird records that in his lifetime.
Eight new birds have been spotted
in just 3 years. And so birds that haven't been seen in his lifetime have reappeared because simply a pair of beavers are breeding. It's as simple as that. Yeah. So if you then extrapolate that and you think of all those insects, all those birds and all the rest of it, the biodiversity net gain, if you like, that difference between before and after is massive. And then this is hard to measure. You then look at carbon. The carbon dynamics of a beaver wetland are actually really complicated, and I'm not going to go into much detail now. Suffice it to say, and I don't know enough about it either. frankly, I don't think anyone really does. I know some people in Helsinki that have done some pretty amazing research, but even they have concluded that actually this is really difficult to calculate because beavers, whether it's organic carbon, whether it's a carbon that's been slowly forming the sediment and it's held in the water or it's in the ground, whether it's carbon that goes into trees are then coppiced by beavers and so on. It's actually really complicated. But suffice to say, there is going to be a reasonable chance of carbon being sequestered, and carbon is greenhouse gas.
Yeah.
So we can add all these things up, and the list goes on for a very long time, that the benefits they could create. However, there are problems, as we have said.
And that's some incredible things you said, and I think one thing that I stuck in my mind there as you were talking about the kind of the benefits that beavers can bring is just slowing stuff down. And that's quite often what we ask people to do to benefit nature, is just to slow down and give life a chance rather than rushing it, like you said, rushing it to the ocean and rushing it through. Just slowing it down can bring life back. Now, I want to talk a bit about what happened in Parliament recently, or what Parliament said. Now, Parliament gave the right to remain to some family groups of beavers on the river Otter in Devon. Now, once that happens, once that kind of was announced and given, what are the next steps or goals for those beavers in that area? Is it kind of leave them to it, or is there a bit more work to do after that?
Well, again, it's not as simple as one would hope, in that after saying yes, they should stay, and of course they should stay, they're a native species. I don't think there was for many people, it was a serious question that government was going to come in and remove them, although that was at one point considered. You imagine the public uproar for removing a native species like that wouldn't be very popular. Yeah. However, what we do next, that's a good question. So, for the River Otter and for that catchment, they're allowed to expand naturally. That's been approved. What about all the beavers in other rivers? The government, and I heard further about it today, has not yet recognised officially the existence of beavers in other rivers. They aren't protected. They're still not regarded as a native species. So, what we would like to see, and we've brought together about 40 organisations which represent all the different groups of farming, forestry, fishing, conservation, and so on. Science, of course, too. Mm. Where we have said to government that we need to see 9 things happen. And one of the first, is to develop a strategy for reintroducing, or I would rather not say reintroduce because it happened many years ago.
Yes, of course, yeah.
To repopulate beavers across their natural, their prior range, you know, across Britain.
Yeah.
And that's got to start pretty early on with recognition that they are native and that they belong here. And that hasn't happened yet. And it's a very simple thing that George Eustace, the Secretary of State for Environment, has it within his power to, you know, just literally flick the pen and move through the beaver from one column on a spreadsheet to another.
Yeah.
So that's a simple thing, but it will take time. Connected to that is actually rather complicated because we're talking then about protection, or in fact in our document to government we've said safeguarding, because protection automatically raises some concerns between some people that if it's too protected a species, then can it be managed? And because it's a large rodent that can be very disruptive, both positively and negatively, they do need to be managed, and it will at some point, particularly so when numbers really become up to capacity, as we've seen in other countries in Western Europe.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, so we need to see that the beavers are sufficiently safeguarded or protected, but really, I think, and my colleagues think, that we should start with management. So we don't need to talk so much about, are they a protected species? It's more that, do we want them back, and are we able to coexist with them? And can we see the benefits in certain places, and where they're a complete pain in the bum, which they might be in some places, particularly, let's say, there was a river that had been straightened and canalised and had a levee, and houses were below the height of the river. You do not want beavers burrowing through those banks.
Yeah.
And they may do, because you could flood a village. And I mean, the chances of that happening are slim, but they might do. So we have to have very effective localised management structures in place where beavers, first of all, people can be educated about beavers, and then, and going to your question about what next, you know, that's where we would start. Recognise them as a native species, and then help inform and educate people so that they know where to go and who to ask for help, and they become normal. You know, we've used that term normalise, not the most, you know, it's a bit of a dry term, but to normalise beavers again, to you know, they're in our history, but they're not in our culture anymore. Let's get them back into our culture. Let's treasure them, but also know, as a climate and biodiversity ally, if you like, a natural climate solution. But also, let's not be too emotional about this. They are a wild animal. They can be troublesome sometimes. And we need those local people, whether they're farmers, fishers, foresters, gardeners, you know, cricket bat, willow growers, whoever you are, you need to know who to call.
Yeah.
And hopefully, those skills will reside within you. So the next thing then, having had some degree of protection and having a national management framework around that, we'd like to see a strategy, and we'd like to see it to be ambitious and to reflect the climate emergency we're in. Mm-hmm. If we know that the beavers can help, which we do, then we need to have government and all these organisations I've mentioned to work together, so it's not just the government, but we all work together and collaborate to make sure this species is restored as part of the current plans. It's very easy in Britain. Our mindset tends to sort of divide things up and say this species here and this species there and this legislation for that. What we'd like to see is we already have catchment plans for our river systems. Let's incorporate beavers into them. Same for our flood defences. Let's incorporate beavers into them. Our English tree strategy that's being developed by the government, let's put them in there too, and so on. Yeah. So we then have them as an integrated part of our nature and also our planning for a hot, wet, windy, pretty scary future.
And that's a lovely way to look at it, as in you saying there, like all these things that we need to sort out, beavers can actually just be placed, well, they can go there and help some out, and they can go there, rather than looking at, like, you know, they can just help with this, there's so much they can do. And around the UK, I've seen on Twitter, and maybe you can answer a few questions about this as well, there's a few people that hold licenses to cull beavers for population control in certain areas. Why is this happening? Is this something that can be a potential issue or a threat to beaver populations, or is it part of the management system?
Yeah, it's a very necessary part for a mature population, because as we've seen in Norway, for example, in Germany, when beavers become so populous that they need to be managed, just like we do with deer. And other species. So we as a trust, as a charity, and many, in fact, I think pretty much all your conservation groups I'm working with would all say the same. At some point, we might have too many beavers. However, the problems that we've witnessed, and what you're referring to there is particularly in Scotland, there's a petition going on at the moment. There are 87 beavers officially killed under licence, and probably more unofficially. It's a protected species. It's a fifth of the population in Scotland. It's frankly bonkers to be killing a climate ally, and one that costs tens of thousands of pounds per pair to restore if we were to release them in England, for example. And the frustration there is manyfold. Particularly, the farmers concerned have felt, as I've understood it from talking to some and from people who work with them, that they haven't had that support that we've talked about. Yeah. We need to learn from this in England. We're way behind the curve, as I'm sad to say is often the case. How can we learn from Scotland? How can we make sure we don't make the same mistakes? How can we make sure fishers, farmers, foresters and so on are supported before beavers turn up? And then the management and support is there throughout, there's funding available and so on, so that reaching for the gun, which incidentally has been done under law through lethal control licenses, most people aren't doing it illegally, there might be one or two, but it's generally people thinking, I don't know what to do, I think I better reach for the gun. Whereas some of the colleagues that we work with and our partners are there actually all along this time have been there to trap and translocate if necessary, which means capturing the beaver outside the breeding season as a breeding pair or even as a family unit if necessary, and moving them to somewhere where they're wanted. And the irony is, in Scotland, the Scottish Government unfortunately haven't allowed them to move out of their current range, which is particularly along the River Tay. And that's a great shame, because obviously it doesn't take much imagination to think that Scotland has a lot of suitable beaver habitat. there's actually 104,000 hectares or something like that that the government themselves, the Scottish government themselves, identified as being potential beaver habitat. And we as a trust and our associates would say, well, come on, don't kill them there, move them there.
So obvious.
And also here, down in England, some of the guys we work with, there's an amazing guy called Derek Gow and his colleague Rasheen Campbell Palmer, incredible, inspiring ecologists and nature restorers. And if they were on your podcast now, they would be have a lot to say about this. It's heartbreaking to see this this precious resource and an animal that has, you know, all the feelings and sentience of other mammals to be destroyed when they could actually help us. And there are people all over England now clamouring, to people like me and my colleagues, Chris, Eva, Sophie and so on, and Derek and Machine, people coming to us every day, literally every day, saying, could we have some beavers, please? So it's something that probably should be used at some point, lethal control, but only really once we've got to the point where we can't fix the problem, or there's an actual emergency, like I mentioned, a flood's about to happen in a village, we've tried to trap the beavers, we can't, okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to terminate them. If that's the case, fine. You know, most people in the conservation movement accept that in extremis that could happen. But yes, there's so much more we could be doing, Ryan, before then. And it's all about education and local support.
And to finish off the show, the question that we always ask our guests is, if you could pass on one bit of advice to everyone regarding the natural world, James, what would you pass on?
I don't think it'd be too much of a surprise, but because I may have said the word once or twice before in my rant, the single word would be collaborate.
Yep.
And if I was to extend that, I would use the beaver as a guide. They use the family values, the humble, hardworking, creative, ingenious, magical qualities of the beaver. Let's take that within ourselves and within our communities, and then humbly go about our work with a sense of urgency, comma, now, exclamation mark.
Absolutely brilliantly put. And James, it's been an absolute a pleasure, but also such an insightful chat about the work that's been going on and is continuing to going on and for future years to come. Thank you so much for joining me on today's show, and I wish you all the best for the rest of the year.
Well, thank you very much, Ryan. And just to say, we're just one of a large group. You know, there are people, I've mentioned some of them, who've been doing this for literally decades, Ryan.
Yeah.
And we're just the latest people to try and help make a bit of a difference. And we're here to help. If anyone's interested from this podcast, please get in touch with Ryan. And we'll be delighted to help you in any way we can. Thanks for the opportunity, Ryan.
No worries. Thank you.
Thanks again for listening. If you'd like to keep up to date with the projects and work that the Beaver Trust are doing, you can do so on Twitter and Instagram at Beaver Trust. You can also follow James on Twitter at JAO Wallace. Don't forget you can get in touch with me at intothewildpod@gmail.com or on social media at intothewildpod on Twitter and intothewildpodcast on Instagram. Whether you just want to say hello, share some thoughts on an episode, or let me know what you want to hear about next. Until next time, keep well, stay safe, and live the good life.